The Kill Zone by Hank McDaggett. Chapter 1. A Man's Life. Billy never knew his father. 2 months before the boy was born, his dad just packed up and left, without a word of explanation. He just left. We never heard from him again. I can't say I missed him much. Once Billy was born, I had everything I needed to keep me busy and happy. He was a wonderful child, great big eyes, curious about everything, always cheerful and smiling. He was never any trouble at all. And the fact that his father wasn't there made a special bond between us. We were always really close. When he was a small kid, Billy collected little plastic soldiers. After a while, he had hundreds of them, from many different periods and places. He used to lie on the carpet in front of the fireplace and play with them. He formed improbable armies of Roman legionnaires, Apache warriors, Japanese soldiers from World War II, English knights in armour, and sent them into battle against one another. These epic combats could last for hours and were accompanied by all the appropriate sounds. Arrows and spears flying through the air, bombs exploding, men shooting guns or crying out in pain. When he was reading comic books, too, he used to make exactly the same noises. Bam, boom, bang, zap, pow. He was in a world of his own. He sometimes asked me where his daddy was. I told him the truth, that his father moved on before he was born. Billy seemed to accept that. But later, I don't know how, he got the idea from somewhere that his dad was a Marine. I know why Dad isn't here, he said one day. It's because he was KIA. What does that mean? I asked him. KIA, he said, killed in action. I corrected him, of course. I told him that his dad was an insurance salesman. But it didn't make any difference to Billy. He stuck to his own idea. Later, when he was a teenager, he seemed to grow out of his fascination with military things. At high school, he enjoyed playing football, but he wasn't a very good student. He used to clown around in class instead of paying attention to his teachers. They all said that he was a smart, pleasant boy, but that he was undisciplined and lazy. His grades were pretty poor. At home, he spent hours and hours in front of the PlayStation up in his bedroom, totally absorbed. Sometimes we had conversations lasting 10 or 15 minutes, during which he never once took his eyes off the screen. When he graduated from high school in 2001, he got a job in the local Walmart putting things on shelves. After a few weeks, he hated the job. It was a difficult period for him. Most of his friends were getting ready to go to college, and naturally they were all excited about that. But how could Billy be excited about working in a supermarket for the rest of his life? Then 9/11 happened. One evening I came back from the drugstore where I work and found Billy very excited about something. He wanted to know where his birth certificate was. "What do you want that for?" I asked. "I just need it, Mum. Where is it?" "Tell me what you want it for." "I've decided to enlist, Mum. I'm going to join the army. They told me I need my birth certificate." That was a shock for me. "The army?" I said. But you hate it when people tell you what to do. You've never been good at dealing with authority. In the army, you have to do everything they tell you. Then it occurred to me. "Is this because of what happened at the World Trade Center?" I asked. "Sure," he said, "partly. But it's not only that. I've thought carefully about this, Mum. I know what I'm doing. I don't want to work in a supermarket all my life. I can do something better than that. I want to be somebody, Mum. And I want to do something for my country too." It didn't make any difference what I said. His mind was made up. A few days later, a soldier in uniform came to the house, a sergeant. The three of us sat at the kitchen table and talked about Billy's future. The sergeant opened a laptop computer and showed us pictures of soldiers climbing over obstacles and driving tanks and jumping out of helicopters. He talked a lot about the educational opportunities offered by the army. "Tell me one thing, Sergeant," I said. "Will my son be in danger?" "Well, ma'am," he said, "I can't guarantee you that he won't. It's a man's life in the modern army, and danger is part of the job. But I can tell you this, the army will do everything humanly possible to keep your son safe, always. After the sergeant left, I asked Billy again and again, Are you sure this is what you want to do? Are you sure? I'm absolutely certain, Mum. And it isn't only something I want to do, it's something I have to do. What if you get hurt? I won't, Mum. Don't worry about that. I'm going to learn about computers. I'll be sitting in an office somewhere. I won't get hurt, I promise you. I guess every 18-year-old boy thinks that nothing can ever happen to him, that he's indestructible. Chapter 2. What makes the grass grow? All through 2002, Billy called me regularly. And when, for one reason or another, he couldn't call, he wrote. I used to look forward to receiving his letters, which were always more detailed and thoughtful than our hasty telephone conversations. Billy had one big disappointment, though, soon after enlisting. His score on the Army's entrance exam wasn't good enough to get him into electronics. So it looks like I'm not going to become a computer expert after all, he wrote. On the other hand, I can train to drive trucks, and you should see the trucks the Army has. Believe me, Mum, rolling down the highway at 100 miles an hour in a 10-ton vehicle is still going to be a lot more fun than piling cans of cat food onto a supermarket shelf. From the start, he loved the Army. I couldn't believe how easily he accepted the discipline and hard physical work. When he was doing his basic training, he even used to complain that the instructors weren't strict enough. But a lot of the things he told me about boot camp scared me too. When he and his friends were marching, they had to chant things like, We're trained to kill, kill we will. Or when they were doing bayonet training, the instructor used to shout, What makes the grass grow? And the soldiers had to shout back, Blood, blood, bright red blood. Don't worry about it, Mum, Billy told me. Maybe some of the guys here take that stuff seriously, but I don't. It's just a game, that's all. After boot camp, the Army sent him to Vicenza, Italy, for 6 months, where he learned to drive many different kinds of vehicles. I can't remember the names of all of them. Billy was really happy there. He told me that he had made a lot of good friends, especially one in particular, a young man called Conrad Barlow. Conrad was in the same unit and was also training to be a truck driver. He was a couple of years older than Billy and was like a big brother to him. Billy's letters were full of Conrad says this and Conrad says that and in Conrad's opinion and according to Conrad. We used to think that the army was going to send us to Afghanistan, he wrote from Italy, but Conrad thinks that Iraq is more likely. I guess you've read about Saddam Hussein in the papers and how he is refusing to give up his weapons of mass destruction. Well, Conrad thinks that sooner or later we're going to have to go over there and do something about the situation. Conrad was right. Near the end of 2002, Billy and he were brought back from Italy and sent to an army camp up near the Canadian border for a week of special high-intensity training. Billy wrote to me from there. Dear Mum, they have told us that shortly we're going to Kuwait in the Arabian Gulf. They have also told us that if Saddam Hussein does not surrender his weapons of mass destruction, we will probably have to invade Iraq and liberate the Iraqi people. That is what this special training is for. The generals think that if there is a war, the hardest part will be fighting in the streets of Baghdad. They want to prepare us for that. So they have built a typical Arab town up here and hired a lot of Arab-speaking Americans to play the local population. The snow on the ground is 2 feet thick, and we are surrounded by fir trees, but apart from that, everything is very realistic. The Iraqis all wear the kind of clothes people wear over there, and speak their own language, of course, and there is a mosque which calls them to prayer 5 times a day. Nobody knows why the army chose to do this training up here in the north and not in Texas or Arizona or somewhere dry. As Conrad always says, the army is a mystery inside a riddle wrapped up in an enigma. Anyway, except for the cold, around 15 degrees Fahrenheit, we are having a pretty good time. We go out on patrols, and enemy soldiers try to ambush us from behind trees and buildings. To help us become accustomed to real combat, we are using rifles that shoot laser signals. There are special electronic sensors on our jackets and helmets. If a laser signal hits you, the sensors make a loud noise. Then you have to open an envelope to find out how serious your injury is. If you're wounded, your buddies have to call in the medics or organise your evacuation by helicopter. As I say, it's all very exciting. It's like being inside a video game, in fact. Looking out the window, I can see that it has started snowing on the desert again. Some of the guys want to go out for an old-fashioned snowball fight, so I guess I'll go with them. I'll write again soon. Lots of love, Billy. P.S. I have just found out that we are leaving for Kuwait in early January 2003. So the good news is that I'll be home for Christmas and the New Year. I hope you've got something nice for me. Chapter 3. How easy it was. Billy spent the first 3 months of the New Year sitting in the middle of the desert in Kuwait doing two things. One was trying to keep the sand, not normal sand but a fine powder like flour, out of the engine of his truck. The other was waiting for Operation Iraqi Freedom to begin. Operation Iraqi Freedom, he wrote. Who is the genius who thinks up the names of these things? Conrad said it's probably some communication expert with a fat salary, or better still, a team of communication experts with fat salaries. Finally, on March the 20th, his unit crossed the border into Iraq as part of the invasion. Billy's truck was in the tail of a convoy of trucks and tanks, which is 2 miles long and which is heading north to Baghdad as fast as it can go. But almost immediately the convoy ran into monstrous sandstorms, which slowed down its progress considerably. On the other hand, there was very little fighting. I have my rifle with me at all times, Billy wrote, but I have not seen any real action. I heard that there has been some fighting up at the front of the convoy, but no important battles, just a few skirmishes. Now and then we hear gunfire and explosions, but almost the only thing we can see is the sand and dust raised by the trucks in front of us. I have been in Iraq for a week now, and I still haven't seen an Iraqi. Day and night the convoy kept moving. Billy and Conrad took turns at the wheel, one driving while the other tried to get a few hours' sleep. It took them 2 weeks to reach the outskirts of Baghdad. By then they were dirty, mosquito-bitten, fatigued and homesick. A few days later, Billy wrote another letter. Dear Mum, I have been in action at last. 2 days ago, as we were entering Baghdad, we ran into an ambush. Conrad was driving at the time and talking as usual, when suddenly there was a huge explosion and a tank in front of us burst into flames. Our sergeant started shouting, "Ambush, ambush, keep moving. Get out of the kill zone." Then I heard gunfire coming from all directions. For the first time since we arrived in this country, I was really scared. But there was no time to be scared. Conrad accelerated and drove round the burning tank while I grabbed a machine gun. I couldn't see the enemy, but there were buildings on both sides of the road, and I started shooting at the buildings. Everybody else in the convoy was doing the same. Nobody could see a thing, but everybody was shooting. The buildings we were shooting at started disintegrating in front of our eyes, and then, as suddenly as it started, it was all over. We were out of the kill zone and driving through the quiet, empty streets again. For no reason, I started shaking like a leaf, but Conrad was really cool. He just put a cigarette in the corner of his mouth and said, "Now, what was it that we were talking about before we were so rudely interrupted?" "Anyway, Mum, the essential thing is that both of us are safe. There is still some fighting out at the airport, but our unit is not involved in that. The main battle for Baghdad is more or less over, and none of us can believe how easy it was. We were expecting fierce resistance, but the Iraqi army seems to have melted away. So you needn't worry too much. I guess we'll be coming home pretty soon. By the way, I should tell you that I'm writing this from one of Saddam Hussein's old palaces. I'll bet you never thought that one day your son was going to be living in a palace, huh? But here I am. It's true that I'm sharing it with about 500 other GIs, but it's still a palace. Our job here, I mean Conrad's and mine, isn't going to be too difficult. The army has given us a Hemet. That's a heavy, expanded mobility tactical truck. A huge vehicle with wheels that are 4 foot high. Twice a day we have to carry food rations and water to troops camped 2 miles away on Highway 1. It's relatively easy work and will leave us plenty of time to watch movies and play video games. The only problem is the heat. It's 110 degrees here at the moment, so I don't think there will be any snowball flights for a while. Well, Mum, I've got to go now. I'll write again soon. Lots of love, Billy. Chapter 4. Lucky to be alive. The generals and military experts on CNN seemed as confident as Billy that it was only a question of weeks before the troops came home. And on May the 1st, 2003, the president himself appeared on television and announced to the world that the war was officially over. I remember watching him and thinking, thank God, thank God. That same evening, Billy called me. The satellite connection wasn't good, but I could hear the excitement in his voice. I'm coming home, Mum. They gave us the date this morning, July the 4th. We can go and watch the parades together. That's great, Billy, I said. That's wonderful news. How are you, son? What's it like over there? Well, to tell you the truth, it's pretty boring and hot. Really, really hot. Listen, Mum, I've got to go. A lot of other guys are waiting to use the phone. I just wanted to tell you the news. I'll see you on July the 4th, OK? I love you, Mum. Bye. But Billy didn't come home on July the 4th. Later, he told me that they were actually sitting on the plane ready to fly out when their commanding officer stood up in front of the plane and said, I'm sorry, boys, but I've just received some bad news. We have to stay another 90 days. At first, everybody thought he was joking, but they soon found out he wasn't. The situation was worsening day by day, the CO said. They didn't have enough troops to patrol the streets. Every man was needed now. All leave was cancelled until further notice. 2 days later, Billy's truck ran over a landmine. We were just rolling along the highway as usual, he wrote, when suddenly there was a blinding flash. I was sitting in the passenger seat, and the explosion blew me out of the vehicle onto the sand. I was unconscious for a few minutes, I guess. When I opened my eyes, the first thing I saw was a cloud of black smoke rising towards the sky. Then I saw our vehicle lying on its side. One of the big front wheels was missing, and flames and smoke were coming from the cabin. As I ran towards the truck, I could hear Conrad screaming. He was still inside. I climbed up onto the cabin and tried to open the door, but it was blocked and I couldn't open it. I tried and tried. Conrad was trapped inside, screaming his head off with the pain. It was nearly 10 minutes before other soldiers and medics arrived and we were able to get him out. He was unconscious by then. I saw that one half of his face was missing and that his legs were crushed into a mess of blood and burned meat and pieces of bone. It was horrible. Poor Conrad. The medics told me that he was lucky to be alive after such an explosion. But if he survives, they said, he will probably lose both legs and have to have numerous operations on his face. By some miracle, Billy himself suffered only minor cuts and bruises in the explosion. But he was never the same after that incident. He called me less often than before, and when he did, I could hear only sadness and anger in his voice. He told me that he found it almost impossible to sleep because of the stress. When he did sleep, he had terrible nightmares. As the weeks passed, it was obvious that the war was far from over. Every day, more and more soldiers were killed, and more Iraqi civilians, too. Every evening, the television showed us pictures of bodies coming home or of horribly injured children in Iraqi hospitals. In September, Billy wrote to me again. It was a strange letter, not like my Billy at all. As I read it, I became more and more scared. Dear Mum, there is something I have to tell you, just in case. This war is a lie, Mum. Don't believe the politicians or the generals. They told us that the war was necessary because of weapons of mass destruction. They told us that Saddam was responsible for what happened on 9/11. They told us that he could launch a nuclear attack in 45 minutes. They told us that the people here wanted us to come and liberate them. They told us that the quickest way home was through Baghdad. They told us nothing but lies. There are no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11. The people here hate us, and we're going to be stuck in Iraq for years and years to come. That's the truth. I've heard that hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Iraqis are dead, and tens of thousands more are injured. And what for? For lies and greed. We've totally destroyed this country. Now we're selling contracts to rebuild it. Was that worth thousands of ruined lives? I don't think so. Mum, we've killed a lot of innocent people here, and I'm ashamed of my part in it. I don't know how we're going to get out of this mess. How can it end? All I want is to be home, Mum. That's all. I love you. Billy. Chapter 5. A Knock on the Door. It was early in the morning. I was in the kitchen, still in my robe and slippers. I was clearing away the breakfast things when there was a knock at the door. At that hour, I thought it was probably the mailman. Maybe it was something from Billy. I was smiling as I opened the door. There were three of them, three men in uniform. I knew immediately from their faces that they were bringing bad news. Oh, my God, I thought, feeling suddenly weak. No, not this. The one in the middle, a major, spoke. Are you Mrs. Catherine Doyle? He asked. The mother of William Francis Doyle? I nodded. Then I heard myself saying, Just tell me, is he dead or wounded or missing? May we please come inside, ma'am? The major asked. I stood back from the doorway and the three of them came in, taking off their caps as they passed in front of me. I saw that the last one, a short, bald man with a tired smile, was carrying a Bible. We went into the living room. For a few moments we stood there awkwardly, nobody speaking. Then the major broke the silence. I'm terribly sorry, Mrs. Doyle. There is no easy way to say what I have to tell you, so please prepare yourself. Your son was killed in action yesterday evening in Baghdad. My mouth opened, but no words came out. Then for some reason I said, K-I-A? The three men looked at each other as if they weren't sure who should answer. Yes, ma'am, the major said. That's right. Killed in action. He opened his briefcase and handed me a piece of paper. It contained only the briefest information. Time of death, place of death, and those three letters, K-I-A, killed in action. We don't have all the details yet, the major continued. Your son was at a checkpoint with four other soldiers when they were attacked by a suicide bomber. A man drove a car full of explosives right into them. They didn't have a chance. Did he suffer? I asked. No, ma'am. He died instantly. He never knew what hit him. I couldn't think of anything else to say. The short, bald one with the Bible asked me if I would like him to stay so that we could pray together. I told him no. I wanted to be alone. They said some other things. That Billy died fighting for freedom everywhere, that thanks to brave and patriotic heroes like him, the world was now a safer place, that his sacrifice was not in vain. They told me not to worry about the funeral, that the army would take care of everything. We'll contact you again in a few days, the major said, when your son's body comes home. Then they left. I walked from room to room, without reason, without purpose, like a person in a dream. The house seemed empty and strange to me, the emptiest and strangest place in the world. After a while, I got into the car and drove to my parents' house. I told them that their grandson was dead. I remember my father shaking his head as if such a thing was impossible. I stayed with them most of the day. then went back home and took some pills to help me sleep. The following days were a blur. I don't know how I got through them. My sisters and their husbands came. At the funeral, there were dozens of people I didn't know, many of them in uniform. The governor was there, and other politicians and newspaper and television reporters. The next day, someone showed me a picture in the local paper. It was of me standing beside Billy's coffin, touching it and weeping. The days passed. A car came and took me to a military base, where I met the commanding officer of Billy's battalion, a colonel. He was a tall man with white hair and a deep voice full of sadness and wisdom. He spoke to me as if Billy was as much his son as mine. He told me not to listen to those who question the necessity of the war. William died defending his country, he said, and the values of his country. He gave his young life for democracy and liberty. For a soldier, Mrs. Doyle, there is no higher cause than that, and no death more honourable. I know you are proud of him, as we all are. I didn't tell him that Billy was one of those who questioned the necessity of the war. What difference did it make now? When I got home, it was late afternoon. I sat down at the kitchen table and tried to remember the last time I spoke to Billy on the phone. I couldn't remember what we talked about. Now there were so many things I wanted to ask him and say to him. Of course, you never think that a call will be the last time you ever talk to someone. On the table were some photographs I found among his personal things. One showed him in the middle of a group of Iraqi children, with a big smile on his face. He didn't look much older than they were. In another picture, he had a heavy automatic weapon around his neck. The weapon made his body look small and vulnerable. A third picture showed just an army sleeping bag and a thin mattress arranged carefully on a marble floor. This is probably where he slept, I thought, in the palace. Maybe that was when it really hit me that he was dead, that I was never going to see him again, or hear his voice, or touch him. I sat motionless at the kitchen table, just staring at the photograph of the empty sleeping bag. I sat there looking at it until night fell and darkness filled the room, and I couldn't see it any more.